As we're making our way here, I've been asked to caution you. We're trying to get the technology cooperating here, which includes rerouting a cable. And so don't trip over the cable. Yeah, the one that Matt's tripping over there, don't trip over that one. There you go. All right, now many of you, I hope, received a lyric sheet. I'm, for the moment, just continuing on in the same vein. So we're talking about early rock and roll and its cultural context. And I want you to be thinking of Brigitte Bardot and Marilyn Monroe and Hugh Hefner and blacks and whites and bluegrass and R&B and teenagers and all these sorts of things. I'll direct your attention to song number 2, which is on page 1. You'll see the songs are organized in here in chronological order. I'm not going to take them necessarily in chronological order here. But I do want you to pay attention to the lyrics to this well-known song. What's this song about? You came along and you moved my heart and it's you. I changed my mind. Great ball of fire. Kiss me, baby. That feels good. Hold me, baby. Well, I want to love you like the leather shoe. You're fine. So kind. Can you appreciate why parents are a little concerned? This is there's a theme that's running through here. I just want to run through some of these songs again. This is the first decade of rock and roll spans from 1954 to 1964. Oh, they've got some more. Thank you. Get those sheets distributed here. The next one there. Now, this is funny. I pulled these off of YouTube, and whoever put this on YouTube it's a hilarious photo montage of wedding pictures, and whoever did so had no idea what this song was about. So this is 6 years after Elvis here, the Shirelles. Completely, you give your love.
But will you love me tomorrow?
How many of you have heard this song before? Those of you who heard it, did you have any idea what it was really about until now? And what's hilarious, again, whoever put this up on YouTube who has wedding pictures, this is not about wedding love. The whole point of a wedding is that you don't have to worry about the answer to the question, will you still love me tomorrow? Right? Why is there tension around the question, will you still love me tomorrow? Not for this reason. All right. All right. So here we go. Let's just keep on going. Dion here. The next one. Whoops. Here we go.
Oh, and I'm the type of guy who will never settle down. Where pretty girls are, well, you know that I'm around. I kiss them and I love them, cause to me they're all the same. I hug them and I squeeze them, they don't even know my name. They call me the Wanderer.
This is the era of wholesome music. You know, when grandpa and grandma were dancing and it was all very clean and moral.
Yeah. divine, but I'm going nowhere. Oh, yeah.
All right, very good. Now, same artist here, came out in the same year. Now, here he is in the persona of the wanderer. Now he's talking about the woman on the other side of the equation here. Run Around Sue.
It's about a girl that I once knew. She took my love, then ran around with every single guy in town.
All right, so this first era of rock and roll from 1954 to 1964, this first decade, I'm going to put time period brackets around that. And I call that the world that Elvis made. That's my name for it, the first era of rock and roll. But I go into these details, getting granular, talk about Elvis, Chuck Berry, look at some of the song lyrics to expose you to the scene at the time. And I want you to try to recognize how much goes into a song. There is a technological story. There is a story about values, values that cross different layers of society, values along race, values along social class, values along generations, values about sexuality, values about on a number of different valences, and I want you to recognize that a song, these are primary historical sources that speak to many, many layers of and facets of culture. And I want us to learn how to read that and to read those connections. And I want to help us not to reduce the story to simply what values are being projected, although I want you to understand that, but what circumstances are being represented as well. This is an interesting time. You would not have had Elvis Presley in 1924. You would not have had Elvis Presley in 1824 because there's a technological context and a social context and a demographic context that fosters Elvis Presley. It's not just the values. Don't limit it to the values, although I want you to understand the values too. I want to, this is a parenting conference. I am a history guy, and I'm tempted just to march forward in history. I will be marching forward in history, but I won't just do that. From time to time, I want to come up for air and offer some reflections. And here, I want to read for you Proverbs chapter 7. Proverbs chapter 7, which I would suggest offers a fascinating story of parenting. Proverbs 7. So there's a lot of times when we think about Proverbs 7, we think about the parenting lesson. But I would also invite you to think about the parenting method in Proverbs chapter 7. All right. So, my son, keep my words and treasure up my commandments with you. Keep my commandments and live. Keep my teaching as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister. And call insight, your intimate friend, to keep you from the forbidden woman, from the adulteress, with her smooth words. My son, listen to me and stay away from the adulteress. You want your children to stay away from the adulteress? Oh, this is interesting. All right, so we should look here. At the window of my house, I looked out through my lattice. and I have seen among the simple, I have perceived among the youths, a young man lacking sense, passing along the street near her corner, taking the road to her house in the twilight, in the evening, at the time of night and darkness. And behold, the woman meets him, dressed as a prostitute, wily of heart. She is loud and wayward. Her feet do not stay at home. Now in the street, now in the market, and at every corner, she lies in wait. She seizes him and kisses him. And with bold face, she says to him, I had to offer sacrifices, and today I've paid my vows. This is a church girl. So now I have come out to meet you, to seek you eagerly, and I have found you. I have spread my couch with coverings, colored linens from Egyptian linen. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love till morning. Let us delight ourselves with love, for my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He took a bag of money with him. At full moon, he will come home. With much seductive speech, she persuades him. With her smooth talk, she compels him. All at once, he follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a stag is caught fast, till an arrow pierces its liver. As a bird rushes into a snare, he does not know that it will cost him his life. And now, O sons, listen to me. Be attentive to the words of my mouth. Let not your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths, for many a victim has she laid low, and all her slain are a mighty throng. Her house is the way of Sheol, going down to the chambers of death. So what we have is the story of an adulteress and a candid, not reserved, a candid presentation of her seductions, of her flattering, of her messaging. And we wind up with the end of the story about the guy who can't help himself and winds up falling into her trap. But I'd like you to understand the vision of parenting, though, that's going on. So Solomon is presenting this lesson, warning about the adulteress, but what is the parenting method by which that lesson about the adulteress is delivered? Hey, son, come over here, look. See, out the lattice window, we're looking out, son. Watch what happens. There she is. You see that guy coming? Watch with me, son. Watch with me. See how this plays out? Oh, it's playing out. Yeah, it's a fascinating vision of fatherhood, isn't it? It is not clap the hands over the son's eyes. Adulteress, adulteress, adulteress. You should flee adultery. How do you flee adultery? By having a candid, square look at it in the eyes, parent and children together watching this story play out. You don't treat your kids, teach your kids to be faithful by extracting them from the culture around. That's not what Solomon did. That wasn't his parenting method. I would suggest to you that there is a vast difference. There's a vast difference between a collection of 14-year-olds listening to music together and a collection of 14-year-olds and 35-year-olds listening to music together. Very different. And then having a conversation about it. It looks different, it feels different, it's a different kind of context, isn't it? Do those moments happen in your experience? Do those moments happen? I would encourage you as parents to create those moments, to cultivate those moments, to nurture those moments. As your kids get older, they will encounter the world around them. In fact, they're encountering the world around them now. You can't pull them away from it. And naturally, you know, the younger they are, you do protect your kids just like you protect your kids from the weather and the elements and things like that. You protect them certainly from cultural things. You're not going to show certain movies to the 4-year-old. of course you protect your kids like that, but you do that with your four-year-old in order to train them to become 18-year-olds and 24-year-olds and people who are making their own decisions when you're not there putting the roof over their head. You don't want your kids culturally to be the equivalent of the 40-year-old still living in the parents' basement, right? And I would suggest to you, I would commend to you this Solomonic parenting method, and think about how this plays out. It's interesting the sorts of things that Solomon is calling the kids' attention to. Notice the time of day. Notice the location. You know, he pays attention to logistical things, to contextual elements, not simply to her messaging, although certainly that's part of it. Notice the cultural form. What's the technological environment going on? Kids, you're listening to this music on Spotify. What does that say about the fact that you're listening to something on Spotify, as opposed to another way of experiencing music? I mean, we're not just talking about the lyrics. We're just talking about, you know, what are you reinforcing about social interactions when you're listening to music on your Spotify playlist? The fact that you're the one who's actually making musical choices rather than music in the living room. Notice that Solomon is paying attention to things like that in addition to the messaging, right? All of those are in play. One of the reasons why I'm going through what I'm going through now is to go back in time, like I said, to help us to see then, in order to try to train us up to notice things now, so that we can be the kind of parents like Solomon was, coming alongside our children, just talking about the world around us, and talking about the world around us in a faithful way, and how the world is experienced, and with whom the world is experienced, and in what kind of situations we get ourselves into when we experience that world. Does it matter when your kids watch a movie with you versus not with you? I remember a good friend of mine. He was an elder in a church in Pennsylvania. His kids are all grown now. He's a little bit older than I am. But when his son was in high school, Christian school, he sat on the board of the Christian school that he founded. That's the kind of dad this guy was. And he's a business guy. He's not an educator. But anyway, his son wanted to go see a movie with his friends. Like, Dad, can I go see a movie with my friends? Well, son, what's the movie? Who are you going to be with? That sort of thing. And this is one of the best parenting examples that I've experienced in years. He said, well, I'll tell you what, I'm not sure that that's such a good idea. Let's talk through it. You know, what's the movie? It's kind of questionable. But what he did is he then took his son the next evening, he took his son out to that same movie. And it was the same night the friend group went out to watch the movie. He went to a different theater so they wouldn't run into the friend group. And there was skin up on the screen. He knew that there was a young lady that kind of struck his son's fancy. And he said, so, sitting there, eyes wide open, so if Judy was here sitting next to you, what would you be thinking right now? Here you are with your friends watching this. What, you know, sitting there during the movie, not clapping his hand over the kid's eyes, but having that conversation in that moment. What would you be doing now with your friends? And his son felt extremely awkward. Seriously awkward. He needed to. I bet Solomon's son was really awkward right here. Don't you think? But come on, Dad. You know, that's a vision I hope that you can capture in all of this. And part of walking through some of these stories from the past is to help serve again, to train your eyes to notice connections, to look at the wider social connections, the technological environment, what that does to social relationships, that sort of thing. The fact that the kids are driving off in cars with transistors is every bit as important to the story of Great Balls of Fire than the lyrics to Great Balls of Fire. The context matters. Imagine the difference between the son is experiencing that adulteress, that seductress. You can imagine the seductress and that boy in another context without dad. Imagine that boy is just walking down the street by himself or with his buddies and sees, you know, is that going to be a little bit different conversation than the boy with his dad? And the dad says, look out the window and watch this. Who are you with? In what social environment? As we experience culture, think about those kinds of things. It's not simply the lyrics to Great Balls of Fire. Do you see that? Who is listening to the lyrics? In what context? In what kind of situation? Is it at church and a parenting conference? That's a good time to talk about sex. A bunch of 14-year-old guys together talking about sex? I'm not sure that that's so healthy, is it? It's not that it's a taboo topic. All right. So think about Proverbs chapter 7 as I continue to press through some of these things. And I'm going to return to my story of music a little bit. But as in terms of context for how to think about parenting and how this applies, I hope that you talk about the world around you with your children and you talk about it in a lot of ways. All right. So we get to this party music. Rock and roll is teenage, angsty teenage, countercultural, you know, challenging conventions type of musical form. And what's going to reach the apogee of that is going to be, let's see here, going to be a group that winds up on American shores in early 1964, the Beatles. And no doubt you've heard of the Beatles. They came in February of 1964, brought to the United States by Milton Berle's rival, Ed Sullivan. Ed Sullivan was a CBS television personality who, interestingly enough, after the Elvis Presley presentation, Ed Sullivan said, this is proper family programming. We're not going to have Elvis on my TV show because we're not seedy like what happened on the Milton Berle show. What eventually transpired, by the way, was that Elvis's popularity was so undeniable, it was so obviously going to serve ratings to have Elvis on the Ed Sullivan show. Ed Sullivan did acquiesce to have Elvis Presley on his show, but instructed the cameraman to film him from the waist up. And so Elvis did appear on the Ed Sullivan show from the waist up. Later on. But when we get to, I guess, the end of this first decade, the high point of it all, the summative culmination, is going to be a band that comes over from Britain, the Beatles. They're brought over, they play on the Ed Sullivan show. Ed Sullivan brought them over for two consecutive weeks and staged some concert performances in the intervening days, so they were on his show for two consecutive weeks, and that went over so well. Ed Sullivan actually brought them back and sponsored a 10-city tour. Sponsored a 10-city tour. By the time we get to the late spring of 1964, the Beatles held 10 positions on the top 100 chart, 10 different songs from the same group, including something that I don't believe will ever be repeated again, including the top 5 spots. The number one song in April of 1964 was Can't Buy Me Love by the Beatles. The number 2 song was Twist and Shout by the Beatles. The number 3 song was She Loves You by the Beatles. Number 4 song, I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles. Number 5 song, Please Please Me by the Beatles. I don't think we're ever going to experience anything like that ever again. They toured again late in 1964, 30 concerts in 23 cities, and this extended into 1965. Ed Sullivan was involved with some of their concert tours at this time when they came to the United States. He had a camera crew as they were in New York and played at a brand new stadium that had just been erected. The Dodgers and the Giants had moved out to New York, or moved from New York, rather, out to Los Angeles and San Francisco to California. And so the city of New York went from three baseball teams in the 1950s to one baseball team in the 1950s, just the Yankees. And they needed another baseball team. And so a business owner named Shea is finally going to get an expansion with the New York Metropolitans, the Mets, playing in a new stadium. And the first thing in Shea Stadium was a Billy Graham crusade, and the second thing was a Beatles concert before the Mets opened their season. And we're going to hear or see a little bit about their concert in Shea Stadium here. Let's see, is this working? There we go.
Do you think the Beatles are out of style?
Never, they'll never go out of style.
Tell me the truth now. Which group do you like better than the Beatles?
The Beatles, all the time. I love them.
There were 55,000 people at this concert. Grossed over $300,000, which some sources
don't
say
you think this
the record
whole Beatle craze is sort of silly and strictly for girls?
No, not really. I think they're very talented musicians and talented songwriters and excellent showmen.
You like them?
Yeah.
How long do you think they can last?
As long as they keep playing, they'll last.
You know, the Beatles bring joy into the world. They're happiness. We forget our kids when we hear Beatle records. They're fun.
Tell me this. How long do you think the Beatles can last?
Well, I wish they'd last forever. They could bring happiness to everybody.
Now, ladies and gentlemen.
Ed Sullivan.
Honored by their country. Decorated by their queen. And loved here in America. Here are the Beatles.
See that police officer clap his hands over his ears? The crowd was so loud, the Beatles had speakers on the stage, of course, that play back to themselves so they can hear themselves, and the crowd drowned out their own stage speakers. They could not hear themselves. So there you see the capstone of 10 years that is the world that Elvis made. But I highlight 1964 and 1965 because some important change is going to come in. And this is going to move us into the second era of popular music or rock and roll music that I want to talk about. I'll remind you that I talked about the 1950s consensus culture. Rock and roll represents kind of a reaction against that consensus culture. But there were other forms of reaction as well. Among those was a socially conscious, social critic type of form. We see this expressed in the beat culture, the writings of, there were people like Jack Kerouac, the poetry of Allen Ginsberg, who did not like the consumer culture that they saw. This was folk, the folk scene. And folk music, by its very nature, is not produced, it's participatory. In folk music, everyone in the room is supposed to sing rather than the celebrity singing. And it's incarnate, embodied in the life of the people in the community that sing it. And so we have folk artists like Woody Guthrie and especially Pete Seeger are going to come around and become very popular in the 1950s. So the very first song, for example, this is which came out in 1950. This is a later performance, a performance actually from the early 60s, of Pete Seeger here. This is emerging alongside Elvis Presley and this scene. This is not the screaming at the celebrity, that this is clapping along with it, participating with it. If I had a bell, if I had a bell. Now he's calling it out to the audience to sing with him. The microphone's not picking up the audience too well, but now he's accompanying the audience as they sing the song. Ring up danger, ring up danger, ring up a morning. Again, the lyrics are, it's the first song on your song sheet.
If I had a song, if I had a song, sing it in the morning, sing it in the morning, sing it in the evening, sing it in the
How many of you have heard this song before? How many of you have sung this song before? Maybe even in youth group or something. Very good. So this is folk music. It's not electrified. Of course, he's in a crowd, so he's amplified. But it's a very different scene. And it's counter to sort of the mass culture that is emerging in the 1950s. Dissatisfaction, remember when I was talking about John Wayne, when I was talking about Julia Child, I was talking about those other impulses, the dissatisfaction, the pushback on some of the mainstream culture. I think rock and roll represented part of that pushback. We just want to party. We don't want to go in for the suburban ideal on the part of young people. But there are other elements of pushback against the mainstream constructed lifestyle of the idyllic 50s. And the folk scene was another one of those pushbacks. This is not a Beatles concert. This is not an Elvis concert. It's also freighted with social commentary, pushing back on the military-industrial complex, pushing back on the Cold War, martial mentality. That's what Pete Seeger is all about. Pete Seeger is going to go on to write songs like We Shall Overcome, which will become an anthem of the civil rights movement, and the civil rights movement is emerging during this time. Where Have All the Flowers Gone? That's another Pete Seeger song. If you're familiar with that song, it's a peace, anti-war song, prominent peace, anti-war songs. Well, folk music became more and more increasingly popular, too. And some young people got into it because they didn't like the commodified and commercialized presentation of rock and roll. And the more commercialized rock and roll got, the more businessy it got, the more you have the folk singers becoming popular, too, because young people want to be sort of anti what's cool, because that's cool, right? One of the most prominent people who's going to emerge during this time is going to be a fellow named Bob Dylan. This song here, it's the lyrics, "The Times They Are Changing," Bill. Number 7 on your sheet.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam. Let me put the waters around you have grown, and accept your lips and you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming, for the loser now might be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing.
Pay attention to these lyrics. There's "the times are a-changing." The old times are going away. Who's associated with the old times? All of the media leaders, the politicians, your parents.
Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall, for he that gets hurt will be he who is down. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times they are a-changing.
This song became something of an anthem at the time. He composed this right around when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, actually debated on whether to perform it at that time. But it came out in early 1964, just as the Beatles were arriving. And so that's when this song comes on the scene. But Bob Dylan then became one of these regulars at a famous folk festival in Newport, Rhode Island. And he became a headliner along with Pete Seeger, Joan Baez. They were regulars at this annual folk festival as he was rising in popularity. And he showed up at this folk festival in 1965. In fact, this footage was taken from the folk festival in 64. But in 1965, he played a set. And he did something that was highly remarkable, audacious. I don't have the lyrics for this one, but he plays a song, "Maggie's Farm," and I hope that you'll recognize what's audacious about it. He brings an electric guitar on stage. This is essentially a protest song against the protest music of folk music. This was shocking to those who showed up at the folk festival. Bob Dylan is actually pulling up the electric guitar that we saw from Elvis Presley and the Beatles at a folk festival with his social conscious raising type of lyrics, his politicized lyrics, and this changes everything. Rock and roll is not going to be the same. This folk impulse that I've been describing with Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, that sort of thing, with Bob Dylan as kind of a crossover, is going to introduce this, and it's going to reshape what rock and roll is. From the first decade, the party music, from 54 to 64, then the year 64, 65, it undergoes a remarkable transition where it becomes the soundtrack for social protest in addition to party music, and it retains its party music sexualized, you know, bacchanal vibe. It retains that, but it gets transformed. One of the best illustrations of this transformation, I think, is to highlight a folk group who came out with this song on their first album in 1964.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping.
1964 folk album, the inaugural album by this group, Simon and Garfunkel.
And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains.
You hear the electric, or excuse me, the acoustic guitar softly behind it.
Of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone. Narrow streets of cobblestone.
After Bob Dylan does what he does, the song gets re-engineered and it's included in their next album, which is a much more popular album.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping.
You hear the guitar?
Left its seeds while I was sleeping.
It's an electric guitar.
And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone.
Drums, electric guitar. Our sound system's not picking up the background well at all. Sorry about that.
The halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold.
Here, I'll back to the original version.
Neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold.
You hear the difference? This is before and after Bob Dylan pulled out his electric guitar at the Newport Folk
Festival. The flash of a neon light.
Solely Paul Simon's acoustic guitar. Over here we have electric guitar, drums. Which I think illustrates that transition that I'm talking about. Just a year apart, these two renditions of Simon and Garfunkel's hit. And of course it's this second version that's going to be the one that's really popular.
10,000 people made.
All right. Very good. So this is going to become a very important and I would say quite remarkable transition that's going to change rock and roll, both in the sounds, the sorts of things they're singing about, the whole scene. So song number 8, many of you are probably familiar with this. 1965.
All the leaves are brown. And the sky is gray.
So you see a lyrical seriousness coming in. Storytelling, poetry. This is not Great Balls of Fire. Sophisticated harmonies.
Into a church, I passed along the way. Well, I got down on my knees and I began to pray. You know the preacher like the call. He knows I'm gonna stay.
What a flute in rock and roll. Can you do that? Well, you can do this after Dylan plugged in his electric guitar at the Newport Folk Festival. So it's going to become this fascinating soundtrack. Let's see here. So like 1966, this song by the Buffalo Springfield. This is song number 10. This is Stephen Stills. He's later going to become the Stills, the Crosby, Stills,
Nash. I got to wear the
like it's time to stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds.
Young people are speaking their minds. This is the year of our most dramatic escalation in Vietnam. The assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963 was important for a number of reasons. Among them was the fact that a lot of people didn't buy the story of the official government-endorsed story. The Warren Commission, overseen by Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, determined that Kennedy's assassin acted alone. There was only one gunman. There was no conspiracy here. A lot of people thought that's a poppycock. Opened the floodgates to serious questioning of government policies, and then when we escalate in Vietnam, the door open from questioning the Kennedy assassination turns into serious questioning of government policy. And so this folk influx into rock and roll then turns rock and roll into a soundtrack for social protest. Social protest that we've been part of folk all along, but now it merges into rock and roll. So we see a lot more seriousness about the lyrics, a lot more attention to social awareness. We wind up with, you know, some of the great protest songs from the time. Let's see, there's one more I'll play for you from 1969. Let's see, where do we go here? Let's see, Fortunate Son, which is song number 12.
Clearwater Revival, let's have a firework.
This is one of the great draft protest songs. Highlighting the fact that there was a social disparity between those who were able to get out of the draft because they could be, you know, get draft deferments versus the lower class who didn't have access to avenues to defer the draft. And so that's what Fortunate Son is all about. All right, so I'll stop it there. Many of you are well familiar with songs of the late 60s. When we think of the 1960s, what pops into your head is actually the late 60s. The first half of the 60s were actually still what pops into your head is the 50s. The transition point was 1964-65, really, and it maps on to this second era of rock and roll, which is message, social awareness-infused, activist, soundtrack-type of music that also has a lot of artistic experimentation in it. You heard the flutes, the sophisticated harmonies, and other elements that emerge from the folk scene, and then it gets developed within the crucible of rock and roll in that new merger. So that's a change in rock and roll. That's rock and roll's times are a change in. And with that, why don't we take another break here, and we'll have more to talk about. 5 minutes?